Session number 12251, Mr. S. Wood, Reel 1.
Mr. S. D. Wood, Reel 1. When and where were you born, Mr. Wood?
Willington, November the 28th, 1916.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
I had two brothers, elder than myself.
And how old were they?
Harold was about 2 years old and Cecil about 4 years old.
What did your father do for a living?
He became a local newsagent, because he was in the ability to find a job because of losing an arm as a young man.
Did your mother work?
Mother helped in the business with my father, as well as looking after us.
What kind of area did you live in?
In Willington, County Durham, purely and simply in those days, it was a coal mining community. There were no other really industry in that area.
Your home, what kind of a home was it?
Well, it was a terrace house shop virtually in the main street, which were all the shops and houses ran together. In those days there was just running water in the house, no hot water, and the obvious typical thing, earth closets out the back in the yard.
How many bedrooms had it?
Well, at that time, two, I should think, in the first property we lived in, two bedrooms.
Was your early life comfortable?
Oh yes, yes, quite, yes. We were well taken care of by family, well fed and well dressed.
When did you go to school?
Well, I went to the Willington Council School, the normal age, and I stayed there until I was approximately 13. Subsequent to my father's death, which happened when I was 10 years old, on the advice of friends, my mother sent me to the Friends Quaker School at Great Ayton, so that I could make my own way in life independent of the family.
This was a public school?
Yes, but it was a private school in which you could apply to go to, and it was a Quaker school at Great Ayton.
And did you have to pay fees to go there?
Yes, fees had to be paid.
And your mother had to meet those fees?
That's right.
Before you went to that school, in the time that you were at Willington Council School, yeah. What was the education like?
I suppose it would be average, difficult to remember, possibly, but I was quite happy at school and I didn't seem to have any real problems at school at all.
Was the discipline quite severe?
Well, I wouldn't say it was severe, but you had to behave yourself probably more so than you have in this current climate.
Did you stay at this school until you were 30? Was it an all-through school?
Yes, it was. It was a council school, and virtually if you passed your exams, you went to the grammar school at Bishop Auckland or Woolsingham or whatever. It was just a normal council school.
This would be the all 11 plus examination?
That's right.
And yes. Did you take that?
Yes, I think I did. And obviously I didn't pass it.
What was the main difference between your council school and your private school?
Well, the smaller classes and the fact that you were doing prep and other work in the evening after other activities, and the smaller classes and individual attention.
Was it residential?
Yes, it was.
How did you cope with being away from home?
I think I settled in very well because I was surrounded by some very good friends which I made there, and I enjoyed it very much.
What particularly subjects did you like?
Well, I got quite good performance figures on my mathematics, the algebra and geometry, all that sort of thing, and I did reasonably well in French.
And did this lead you to any qualifications?
Well, the qualifications, they entered you for a variety of exams. The first exam was at Uni Oxford, and I've got a postcard. I think I passed that with honours. Then it was the school certificate, and I got, I can't remember, I've got it somewhere, the certificate. So I got adequate O-levels to allow me to go on for the matriculation, which was then A-levels, and I did about five, I got five or six of those as well, on my matriculation certificate.
Were you able to use these qualifications?
Well, I tried to use them. Leaving school and applied for a variety of jobs, and including trying to get in the Air Force and Special Police Forces and things like that, but the employment situation at that time, we're talking now about 1936, was probably worse than it has ever been in the country's history. And I had just stayed at home and helped at home, and until a friend who I'd been to school with invited me to come to Darlington and see about joining the company, and I was offered a job as an office boy at £1 a week.
Which company was this?
The Darlington Simpson Rolling Mills.
And what year was this?
1936.
Did you feel, though, that your education helped you in your work?
Oh, yes. Yes, I mean, it was obvious I had to start from the ground up, because it was a different environment entirely, into a steelworks or a rolling mill specifically. But the fact that as the office boy you got into the works, you were picking up all the documents and information being coming back in the office, so I was able to acquire knowledge going out by talking to people. And also because I became an active member of the football team, I had around me lads working in all parts of the works who were quite prepared to fill me in all the queries I'd had about, well, what happens here and why and all the rest of it.
So you said you got £1 a week. What hours did you work?
Well, virtually 9 till 5. But as I was still living at home, I was travelling on the 7:30 workman's train from Willington to Bishop and through to Darlington until 5 o'clock, and then I was going to evening classes down at the Darlington Technical College from 6 till 9.
And then finding your way back home.
And then I caught the last bus home and got home at 11 o'clock at night.
How often was this? Was this every evening?
3 nights a week.
Did you have to work on a Saturday?
Yes, Saturday until about 12 o'clock.
You said that you were going to technical college. What kind of qualification were you
going for? Mackay.
And how long were you there?
Well, I didn't finish that because the war arrived. I passed my first year. And I was in my second year, and of course the war came on the scene.
You mentioned sport. How important was that in your life at this stage?
Well, it was a great part of my life. I was brought up in a footballing community. My father was the secretary of the Willington Football, and I played football for the local junior team and the Northern League team. And when I went to Eton School, I was fortunate enough to get my colours for cricket and football, and ultimately by the end of my final year I was the athletic champion, and I held 3 records for the 100 yards, the long jump and kicking a football.
So you consider yourself a pretty healthy and fit young man?
Yes, I was all round athlete at that time, definitely.
Did you get involved with the Church Ladder Brigades or Boy Scouts?
No.
How long, it was 1936, I believe you said, when you came out of school and started work.
Well, it was 36 I started work. I'd been, it was 18 months, virtually 18 months from leaving school. At 17 and a half, I was about approximately 19 when I started work at the rolling mills.
For that 18 months, what were you doing?
Looking for any job I could get. And even with the qualifications I explained, a junior Oxford, a school certificate, and a matriculation certificate. The marketplace was so bad at the time, even travelling about, I couldn't get a suitable job.
Was there any kind of benefits for people who were out of work at
no,
that stage?
No.
When did you join the territorials?
Easter 1939, when I came back from Birmingham. I'd been down to the other section of the rolling mills, had some old rolling mills down there. I'd done a 6 month tour down there, and I came back on the Easter weekend, and my friends had been persuaded by a chap called Captain Harry Brown, who was in the territorials and keen, And he persuaded those laddies to go down, and as I turned up on the scene, Justin Tan said, you better come along and do the same. So I said, okay, fine, we'll do that.
What did your family think of this?
They weren't unduly concerned at that time. I don't think anybody was expecting to develop into anything such that it was developing.
How did you actually join? What was the process of joining a territorial unit?
Well, frankly, I remember going down to the drill hole with, and we're all sworn in, you know. But apart from that, there was nothing untoward or special about it. You went down and signed and were sworn in, and that was it. And you went down two or three nights a week for your drills.
There was no medical given?
I can't remember, quite frankly.
Where was the drill hall?
At Larchfield Street in Darlington.
Can you describe the hall? What did a drill hall actually look like?
Well, it looked like the old church hall, a high building with beams and wooden floors and a platform at the far end and various rooms off with the equipment and that in.
You'd be given a uniform.
Oh, yes.
What was it like?
Just khaki drill, the old battle dress. So, you know, boots, that forage cap.
And which company of the regiment was?
504th Searchlight Regiment.
It was a Searchlight Regiment then?
Yes.
Now, you would be what kind of training did you do for a Searchlight Regiment?
Well, it was a question of the two main things were, there was the searchlight itself, there was the generator, and there was an antiquated listening device which was virtually four horns mounted on a rotating thing, which you had headphones and you listened for the sound of an aircraft. So you had to cover all those in case you could rotate your duties. Mostly laddies who'd been motor-minded, and were put in charge of the diesel unit, which was just a huge diesel unit, which had a crank and press all the compressors in to start it up. And the searchlight was virtually just adjusting the carbon rods and putting a switch in, and there was nothing really difficult about the operation of that.
Do you recall any of the measurements of this light?
Not at this stage, but I can probably come in with it later.
So you had a searchlight, was there just the one searchlight?
Yeah, on every site, what there was, if you took the coastal belt, there was a grid put on there. So there would be one, you know, a pattern, and on the site would be virtually about, there'd be a sergeant, corporal, and about 12, with a coop to look after you. We were in tents, and you had a generator, a searchlight, the listening, and a machine gun.
What kind of distances were there between each of these sites?
I wouldn't know. I can't recollect, but I can check at a later stage and give you some idea from maps that I've got, you know, the distances we were apart.
So you were training in this searchlight wouldn't be in Larchfield drill hall or the area?
No, that was just the drill hall where you did your training. And what happened that just prior to this calling up, we actually were going to our annual camp at Wingate. It was halfway through this annual camp at Wingate. We were called back to the drill hall in the dead of night, virtually, arriving about midnight, and each unit then withdrew all its stores, the searchlight, generator, listening apparatus, machine gun, rifles, tin hats, respirators, given the map reference, and we were deployed throughout the night, all down the coast with our headquarters at Filey, virtually from there down to Bridlington and inland as far back as Driffield.
What date was this?
As near as I can, going back to this thing about August 14.
And which particular site were you on?
I was at one, actually, on the south side of Bridlington itself, next to the golf course and behind a farmer's building, very, very close to the coast.
Before we go further with the searchlight, Mr. Wood, what was your initial training in Larchfield Street Hall?
Well, the training was concerned with the operation of the diesel unit providing the power for the searchlight, the operation of the searchlight, and the use of the very which was a unique listening, which was just four horns mounted on a tripod with earphones for the tracking and guidance to the searchlight for the following of any enemy aircraft which possibly came across our area.
This was done with posters or books or...?
No, the equipment was there. So you had everything there that you would have used in the case of the war breaking out. Well, it was there, the diesel, the searchlight and the listening apparatus and the machine guns and rifles and whatever.
Did you do any basic training drills?
Yes, basic arms drill and use of EN fields and throwing a grenade and the like.
Was there any fitness training to make you
fit? Just a modicum of PT. There was no real strenuous activities because we had full-time jobs. This was just part-time, two or three nights a week down in the drill hall.
You didn't do any route marches or
not
parades?
Not at that stage, no.
You were given basic equipment, as you say, uniforms, so forth. Yes. Did you take that home with you?
No, you just had your uniform, but the rest of the equipment stayed in the drill hall.
Was there any means of checking it through inspections of any kind?
Well, there was a check every time, but virtually the only thing you had when you went home was the uniform. All the rifles and all the other stuff was in the armoury at the drill hall, so there was nothing really you took away from the place.
So previous to this unit had been one of the battalions of the Durham Light Infantry. When you joined it, was there any kind of move from the Light Infantry Regiment, where all the traditions were, into a searchlight battery situation?
In the time until the outbreak of war, I never heard any reference made to this at all in my group.
Come back now to the searchlight training and the activities that you were doing. Were you linked in any way with anti-aircraft batteries?
No, not at this stage. We had our own machine gun, and that was the only means we had of deterrent if we were in the field and the plane went over or happened to come close enough to be engaged. That's all we had.
So in theory, just a few months before the outbreak of war, you would hopefully be expected to pick up an aircraft and then shoot it down with a machine gun?
If it came near enough, yes.
What kind of power and system did was used with searchlighting and to get onto aircraft and to hold?
Well, the searchlight itself was got its power from a Lister diesel generator, and the searchlight itself was directly linked to that, but it was manually operated under instructions given by the laddies who were using the four listening horns mounted on the tripod, or bracketing, to pick up the direct sound, and they would say move right, up, down. They were virtually verbal instructions,
So they would shout out to the people who were manhandling the searchlight?
Yeah, or if they were... Obviously, there was a distance between the searchlight and the doings, and there would be a failed telephone from that point to the searchlight laddie who controlled the movement laterally and vertically of the searchlight.
And were you trained specially to do the particular jobs?
Yes, you had a chappie who was the diesel generator. You had, all right, you were trained to fit into each unit, but invariably the diesel generator, that was his job. You probably would switch round from the listening to searchlight control on a sort of a rotating sort of sequence.
How was the searchlights got around the countryside? Or were they fixed in one side, or were they moved or movable?
No, once they got on, this was a pattern which had been predetermined by the War Ministry of, and this particularly of coastal and inland, there was obviously a map where they'd marked where you needed them, so they could all cover the whole of the sort of country, really, inwards and eventually right around the main towns as well.
Was there any kind of link with the RAF?
Not at this stage. Not at all. When we were being deployed from the drill hall, just slightly prior to the outbreak of war, we were given a map preference where we had to put down our equipment, and obviously this had been predetermined in conjunction with the defence people. This is the pattern where the searchlight would fit down the coast and back inland.
Did you have any exciting episodes of or clashes with the local people?
No, the initial was quite remarkable because it was the holiday season and Bridlington was a popular holiday resort, and when we arrived there, 10 days before war broke out, they were dancing on the pier. There was a famous band there, Herman Daruski. The lights were on, everybody was enjoying themselves. People were applauding, they were leaving food and presents at the gate. And if you're on night duty, the people across would come and have a put your rifle down and come and have a cup of tea. But from the moment war was declared on that Sunday, it was quite an amazing coincidence. We'd withdrawn from the stores at Driffield, piles of barbed wire, we call it dammit wire in those days. And on the Monday morning, we had to go down and wire all the front of the pier area with this barbed wire. And apart from one man and his dog, the 3,000 or 4,000 people who had been dancing on the pier and walking on the sands, it evacuated overnight on the Sunday, and Bridlington was completely deserted. The whole front was free, except I remember putting up the dannet wire on that occasion. All that day we saw one man and one dog.
At what stage, so close to this, to the war situation, at what stage, Mr. Wood, did you feel that war might be coming?
Well, that's quite clear in my mind. It was when we were, our annual camp was broken up and we were deployed back to the drill hall and sent out to the predetermined sites in a case of an emergency taking place. 10 days before war was declared, we were being deployed. So obviously there must have been some risk or possibility that the war breaking out at any time. So this was when we realised that possibly, well, this was going to be it.
Had you mobilised a few days earlier than the rifle regiments?
I wouldn't know, because there were no such units in Darlington. Darlington was the only, as I know, the territorial unit in Darlington. So I was not aware of any other mobilisation which is taking place.
In moving amongst the people around you, did you get the feeling that they felt war was coming, and was it depressing in any way?
It's rather difficult to explain, because the Sunday when war was declared that morning, as I've said previously, Bridlington was teeming with people. The fact that war was declared and people evacuated so quickly and went back home and the town became deserted obviously pointed to the feeling that things were not going to be very good in the very near future.
What were your feelings, the knowledge and, of course, the actual fact that war was declared? What were your actual feelings at the time?
Well, it was difficult to absorb because, we were sort of remote, if I say, sitting in a field there with no real contact with anything else. But we knew, obviously, like everyone else, we listened to the radio and the negotiations which were taking place. And then when war was declared, well, that's it. But it was difficult to envisage exactly what was going to happen then. Just sitting there in this field, you virtually sat there and just hoped for the best.
There weren't any feelings of excitement or?
Well, there was not a lot to get excited about. The only problem being, at that stage, you knew you weren't going to go home for a long time or whatever. So that was a bit.
What happened next then?
Well, obviously, as the weeks and came into winter, we had a very moderate winter the first time. We had blizzards and snow, and we were out in tents. We hadn't been provided with huts and proper latrines or anything, so it was pretty rough, living rough as it were. We were changed down at various sites. Some got promotion to Lance Corporal, and people moved around. So you moved. Our headquarters was at Filey, at the hotel there, and I did go on a course, a PTI course at York Railway Institute, because we were getting an influx then of news people coming in, and we were fairly well sort of eventually got really organised, and we started getting huts and stoves and some sort of shelter, but the first winter was not particularly conducive to comfort and joy.
Were you still training?
Well, yes, but we were in action, so we did a drill every night before we checked the equipment and everything else was done, before night came. And we stood by, and there was always one chap on guard all night on a rotating duty. And the form was in the tent, or eventually into the hut, where the sergeant would pick up his call from headquarters that there was air activity in some district approaching, and to be on the alert.
Did you have any actual air activity in those very early days?
We did have one incident when we were called out, and we could hear this plane coming, we roughly said, from a southwesterly direction. And we listened in, and we actually struck the searchlight, which means we put the searchlight on, and we heard this plane sort of zoom down. The next thing we knew, at the far end of the field force, there was a thrumping, thunching noise, and it turned out later that it was a 100-pound bomb.
But you didn't spot the aircraft?
No.
That must have been quite exciting, was it, at the time?
Well, it wasn't worrying, but we just didn't know what to expect. We didn't know what the plane was, friendly or foe. There was a plane up there. It didn't do anything other than dive low down, and then it went out virtually over Flamborough Head out to sea, and we assumed then it must have been a German reconnaissance plane. But
was aircraft spotting part of your training?
Yes, you had to identify, you know, the different types of planes.
If there'd been an attack in daylight, what would your role have been?
Well, just the same. Just stand. I mean, the only weapon we had on the site was a Lewis machine gun, so we just use that to the best of our ability.
How was the searchlight or searchlights operated if an enemy aircraft came over and you were looking for it and getting onto it?
Well, obviously, as I explained before, we're using a listening device, and we were directing the laddie on the searchlight to move right, left, up, down, and if it so happened that your particular searchlight or one nearby illuminated the plane, all the others then would immediately converge and try to keep move tracking, so they had a convex, a crisscross of light, which would enable A, anti-aircraft, or B, our night fighter, if there were any in the area, to intercept.
And this was still very largely visual?
Yes. And hearing, with, as I said, with the...
Was it difficult to hold something like that with just that rather primitive equipment?
Yes.
And if you lost the aircraft, obviously, you would just...
Continue researching again.
Was this done in any kind of grid system in a small area?
Yes, well,
at a time.
As we explained, when we got these map references, really, to which sites we had to go to, they were a pattern, you know, across the coast and inland, so that there was a triangulated area where there was searchlights on a predetermined pattern.
Was there any improvement in equipment in the early months of the war?
No, none whatsoever.
And were you still using your Lewis gun for how long?
Until I left the unit. I was with them at about 18 months before I took a commission. And we were using exactly the same 18 months later.
And there'd been no link up with any anti-aircraft?
No, we had no anti-aircraft.
In all that time?
No.
And was that the same with the RAF, or did you have some kind of direct contact with
the
fighter?
No.
How was your time allocated during the course of a full day?
Well, if you took a normal day, there was the maintenance and checking of the searchlight and the diesel and quality equipment. And obviously, in the daytime, because of lack of facility, you'd probably take a lorry load in to Scarborough, to the baths and things like that, or you'd go to headquarters for medical checks or whatever, so that when by the time you got the end of the day, it's time to dusk, you check the equipment again, retire to your tent or hut as it became eventually, and there was always a guard on duty for an hour, and he rotated throughout the night. If we got a call out and stand to, everybody would turn out and man all the equipment such that we had to whatever period of time, and if no activity took place, we would be stood down from headquarters and resume our nightly one sentry duty.
So headquarters would inform you that you were needed to stand to because there were
activity in the area. Mm.
And where were they likely to get that information?
Possibly from the Air Force.
Did you find yourselves curiosities in the area for people coming to
initially,
see you?
Yes, and we were very welcome, and people used to leave parcels at the gate because they assumed we were not getting as good a food as we should be getting. Also, if you were fortunate enough to be on the sort of dawn patrol, 8 o'clock in the morning, wandering around at daylight, you'd often be invited into people's house because they were for a cup of tea and back in again. But subsequently, after the first bomb had dropped, apparently there was a deputation from the town mayor to have the searchlight move further afield because it was attracting the enemy bombers to Bridlington.